Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. And oh my God, are we going to have an interesting show. Wait a second, what did I just say? Oh my God. God? What does God have to do with it all? What do we know about God? Well, this show, I think, will talk about it. And not only that, I don't think this is a show for you religious listeners. So you know, you might not be interested because you already know all about God. This is for people who have questions. I think we're going to be very interested in some of I don't know if we can call them answers that we come up with, but some different points. And to do that, to help us do that, is the author of a book called There Is No God. Oh, my God. Is that the name of this book, There Is No God? And He Is Always With You. Oh, okay, that makes it sound better. And it's A Search for God in Odd Places. And to help us talk about his book, is the author of this really wonderful book to read. And he's been on the show before. So welcome back, Brad Warner. Brad, welcome.
Good morning, morning. Must be morning.
Yeah, it's still morning here in the East. I know it's morning for you out west. So,
yeah, for sure.
What's that?
For sure.
Yeah, right. You might have just gotten up. So, or finished your meditation.
Yeah, actually, I did.
Okay, good. And, you know, the exciting thing is that you're talking about or examining God from the point of view of this godless religion, Zen Buddhism, because you are a Zen Buddhist monk. And we all know that Zen Buddhism is godless, right?
Well, that's the reputation, yeah. I mean, that's kind of, if you look back at some of the earliest literature about Zen that people know, like D.T. Suzuki's Introduction to Zen, that's what he says very clearly, that Zen Buddhism is a religion without God, you know, almost in those exact words. But I kind of feel differently. I feel like maybe God means a lot of different things, and that in some ways of defining God, you could say that Zen Buddhism is very much about God.
Yes, from your point of view, but then again, you're a heretic.
Well, yeah, that's true. You know, and you got to deal with that kind of stuff. But I think it's how can I put this? I think it's okay to use this word God, but I've been traveling around the country talking about the book, and some of the response I've gotten has been quite impassioned. I kind of expected that, but it's always interesting to see. People people on the Buddhist side don't like you using God in their godless religion, and people who are more conventionally religious, at least in Western terms, don't like God being defined in a way that they're not comfortable with.
Well, my family has a background in Unitarian Universalist, and that's a religion but it's not a dogmatic religion, and it attracts a lot of people from very dogmatic religions who are trying to get away from statements about God and the whole creation that the religious nature of God that they object to. So they're not happy when God is spoken about in these Unitarian Universalist services because it makes people uncomfortable.
Well, you get the same thing within Zen because it's a very similar situation. I think there are a lot of cases of people who they go through a religious upbringing in their childhood and they get kind of a sense of some kind of, you know, transcendent reality, maybe you could call it, but then their religion isn't really helping them with that, so they reject that, but they're still interested in something, I don't know, I don't want to say beyond this world because it's not really beyond this world, but something more, something that conventional understanding of life and the universe and everything doesn't address. So they'll come to a place like Unitarianism or Zen. But they don't like the word God being spoken of, and I can understand that. But I also think the word God is still useful because it gives a more personal sense to this sort of transcendent reality, which I think is a component of it. Not that transcendent reality is a person in the way we understand it, but it's a living thing. And I think the words that we used that denude it of its sense of being alive, they're kind of unfortunate.
Well, I think that the problem people have with God is the background, historical background of religions painting God as some guy out there, almighty, who makes judgments, and if you pray hard enough, maybe your team can win the game.
Yeah, and that's a problem. I think, you know, it's my supposition, but I think it's pretty much borne out, and if you look at the history of things, is that a lot of the people who initially founded these religious movements, maybe Buddha and Christ and these kind of people, they were talking about some rather personal, deep experience they'd had, but they were forced to use the language available to them.
Well, they had by society, who couldn't understand them otherwise.
Right. And so when you use God in a sort of metaphorical sense, because you don't have another word for this thing you've experienced, then people will put into their own, they'll create their own definition of God. And then you have the later sort of official interpreters of these initial founders of the movements who don't understand the movement to begin with. You know, they don't really get it, but they've somehow risen to the position of being the official interpreters of something they themselves do not understand, and so they create something, you know, often horrible out of what was initially an attempt to describe something transcendent and ultimately really wonderful.
Right, and there are a lot of ministers, often evangelistic ministers out there, talking about that they personally talk to God, and mm-hmm. God tells them how to minister and then how to instruct others.
Well, you get a lot of people speaking for God, but I think that's probably a dangerous position to put yourself in, because, you know, God says a lot of things to a lot of people if we can talk in those terms. And setting yourself up as the as the one spokesman for God is just a recipe for disaster, I think.
Right. Well, even the book Conversations with God, the author of that says, "I'm not. This isn't really about God speaking to me. I am being spoken to, but let's not call it God."
I think that's probably a good thing to do. You know, depending on what you mean by God, that's why I called the book There Is No God and He Is Always With You, because I think it kind of depends on what you mean by God. To outright reject God and say it's absolute fantasy, hallucination, and nonsense is a mistake. But then on the other side, to go out and say, I know what God wants, and God wants me to hate homosexuals or you know, this kind of nonsense, is also a big mistake. So the answer is kind of somewhere in the middle, and we're uncomfortable, I think, as human beings with these answers that are in the middle, because they're not one or the other.
We kind of can't translate God into our material reality.
Well, yeah, that's for sure, and it's hard to accept the contradictory nature of the reality that we live in, because we don't, you know, we don't want it to be contradictory, but it is.
Well, it's worse than that.
Yeah,
we live in an inhuman society.
Well, yeah, it's. You know, part of the nature of reality is to be kind of two things at once. And so, you know, the mind wants to have it one way or the other, and because that's what your brain is in there in your head trying to do. It's trying to say, is this poison or is it water? You know, you have to know these things in order to survive. But then when it comes to something like God, you make a decision, and then you really... all of us are very inclined to want to stick with that decision, because it's hard to change your mind. It's hard to see things another way.
Well, but, it's also about survival, like you said.
Yeah,
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're afraid we won't survive if we keep changing our mind too much.
That's right. And it's not really, you know, I use that phrase, changing your mind, but it's not really changing. It's being flexible. You know, Dogen, who founded the type of Zen that I studied in, they asked him, what did you get when you went to China to study Buddhism? He was Japanese. And he said, I came back with nothing but an open and flexible mind, which I think is really, really crucial.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And that's so much about how to understand this, because the mind can only carry so much information and interpret so much information. And so a lot of your book examines how our minds are influenced and how we see the world and have these experiences in our religions and in our spiritual lives that have to do with our thought process.
Well, yeah, everything can be kind of captured and manipulated by human thought. So even a true experience of a kind of transcendent reality or something, you know, along those lines, can be co-opted by the ego into something that that serves, you know, your selfish purposes. And we have to kind of be careful with that. I mean, one of the things I talk about in the book is my own kind of experience of this sort of, you know, this sort of transcendent experience or transformative experience, which often I think there's a chapter in the book called Enlightenment Porn, and I feel like often people may have a genuine experience of something like that, but they're inclined to use it in such a way as to impress others or to make themselves seem greater than they really are. And I don't know, I like talking about it and then being kind of an idiot and then going, look here, even an idiot can experience this.
I've had a lot of people come up to me, and you probably do also, and ask you how enlightened you think they are.
How enlightened I think those people are?
Yeah.
Yeah, I get that from time to time, and you know, it's impossible to answer that sort of question. I think if you have to ask somebody about that, then there's your answer. Right?
Well, I always say to people, now that you asked, probably a bit less than you originally thought.
Yeah, because that sort of experience is kind of like, there's an old Zen story about a guy stubbing his toe on a rock and then having this experience of kind of ultimate transcendent reality. And part of the reason for that story is to give you the understanding that the experience is like that. It's so definite that it's like stubbing your toe on a rock or something like that, where you can't, you don't need to ask somebody.
Yeah.
You don't need to say, did I have this experience? You know, but there's a whole business, like an industry almost, of people having, you know, so-called enlightenment experiences and then, I don't know, verifying them for others.
That's that porn business you were talking about. Enlightenment porn. Well, it's not that, you know, I've had these experiences and I seldom mention it to anybody. And I'm not even looking for more of them. I wouldn't mind it, but it's not like, oh my God, I got to keep doing this because it validates me.
Right. There's somebody I cite in the book, a friend of mine who was another Zen teacher, and she told me she just had one of these that they called Kensho in the parlance of Zen. And she said, I only had one Kensho experience, and that was enough. And in writing that, I realized that could sound like bragging, like I had the ultimate one or something. But the way she said it was sort of like, you know, I ate fried worms once, and once was enough. You know, it was sort of... It was an important experience to her, and it really shaped her life. But it's also something that that you don't need to go into again and again, because, you know,
you talk about it. Yeah, you talk about it in the book about your own experience and how you can't even identify it in time or even in identity.
Yeah, that's kind of an ongoing weird thing when I reflect on that. That kind of first big moment of, you know, whatever you want to call it. is that I don't even remember what year it happened, because it happened outside of the typical framework of time.
And in that's why it's still happening. And that's maybe why you don't have to keep trying to find it again.
Well, I suppose so. Yeah, you don't really. But you know, there's a whole, like I said, a whole industry of people who are you know, making a lot of money by presenting others with their grand experience. And I don't know. I'm not sure how healthy that is.
No, it's a business. So it's exciting to talk about this with you, because you, being the unique Zen Buddhist monk that you are, you're not even always appreciated in Zen Buddhism, because you are questioning so much. And yet, what you question is the mind.
Yeah. Well, and I think one of the things that initially attracted me to Zen in the beginning was its ability to question even itself, which I came to it out of the punk rock movement, and I was really into the hardcore punk scene because it seemed to be questioning everything. But then I found out you couldn't question punk rock itself. You know, it was sort of sacred. And what I was really excited about within Zen is that Zen allowed you to question even Zen. You know, there's a famous sutra called the Heart Sutra, in which it categorically goes through and denies all of the basic tenets of Buddhism, which would be like finding a secret passage in the Bible in which it said, you know, there is no savior, there is no God. You know, you're just kind of mind blown by that.
The Vatican hides those statements.
yeah. But I'm kind of depressed sometimes in the Zen world. Not everybody. It doesn't happen everywhere. But there are certain little factions within the Zen world that don't want to take Zen all the way, you know, and don't want to. You know, you can't say God within the. You know, people a few people are getting very vocal about the idea that I shouldn't even say. You shouldn't even talk about God. Like, well, why not? You know, because it's part of our culture. If we're Western people, we have that in our cultural understanding of things. Whether we say we believe it or don't believe it, it's still there. And I think we need to confront that, or at least
right. And to say not to do that creates a religion.
Yeah. It very much does. And what I liked about Zen is that it's free, or in its ideal state anyway, free from all of that religious stuff. There are ceremonies and chants and things we do, but all of them are open to question. And as I said, some of them even question themselves right within the chant that you're chanting in the morning at the temple, which I think is really important, because religion is about providing an answer, the answer, and then you finalize it, and then you I don't know, supposedly, I guess you can move on with your life. But Zen is about constantly asking the questions and never accepting anything as a final answer.
Right. Now, there's a statement you make in the book about meeting God. What if God could stand in front of you and say, "I am God"? What does that say to you?
Well, I remember when I was a teenager being asked that question. I just entered college, you know, and there was a group on campus who were, you know, talking about God and all that. And somebody and one of them said that to me, and I said, well, I guess I'd bow down and worship him or something. You know, I don't know what.
Well, you were still young.
but I think actually my answer now would be, who are you? You know,
right? Because then you're separate, and here you say God is always with us, but not as a separate being.
Yeah, God is kind of our basis, and I think it's okay, at least in certain contexts, to use the dreaded G word, God, to refer to that, because we are part of something bigger
Right.
But at the same time, that bigger something is also contained within us,
right.
You know, within
right.
our finite selves.
It's beyond distinction. And so in the book you talk about to experience God, we have to give up our distinctions. For instance, you talk about between a wino and a Subway seat. As long
yeah,
as you know
yeah.
the difference, then you can't experience God, because there is no distinction. God is a oneness, and here we're talking about a duality.
Yeah, and I think one of the important things is to be able to kind of maintain both. I mean, you
right, right.
You make your way through life by being able to distinguish the wino from the Subway.
You have to.
You have
survival.
To, you know, so that you know where to sit down.
Right.
But on the other hand, it's good to also have this kind of more transcendent perspective that says, really, there is ultimately no difference. And I think that can be useful, too, because you stop seeing people and things as being other, you know, and start saying, well, this is in some real way an aspect of me, and therefore I should treat it with respect and with kindness.
Right. And God isn't other also.
Yeah, God is not other in one sense. You know, I keep going back to that Buddhist sort of contradictory thing. In one sense, it's not other. But one of the reasons I use the word God is because there is kind of an aspect of otherness to it, you know, depending on how you look at it. So you are... My first Zen teacher told me this thing years ago. He said, it's more you than you could ever be. And at the time... I'm just baffled by that statement, which is why I think it stuck with me for so long, because I couldn't make heads or tails out of it. But as I carried on in this practice, I kind of saw that there is something that's more me than I could ever be. And yet
right.
I can approach it as an observer, and I can approach it as subject, you know, as
right.
if I am... looking through its eyes.
Well, the observer can only approach it through your mind, and our minds can't be as big as everything. So
yeah, that's
where we're limited, is in our mind. So then any discussion of God has to be a discussion through our minds.
That's right. You can only describe things in the terms that your your brain understands. You know, even when you're trying to describe it to yourself. I mean, I had a limited sort of experience of, you know, I lived in Japan for a long time, and I learned Japanese, and learning a second language, I think, is really good in so many ways. And one of them that doesn't get a lot of press is that it can almost transform your way of understanding reality, because you see that here are human beings who understand reality in a very different way. And you can still communicate with them,
right? Through meaning,
yeah.
and that's to me that's why I can appreciate that all these people there who speak languages I can't even understand are actually speaking the same meanings that I am.
Well, yeah, that's the interesting thing, and you discover new areas of meaning,
right?
You know, and then in the Zen thing, there's this idea of going beyond all words and saying, okay, before you name the thing, it is what it is. Before you name yourself, you are what you are. That's amazing to me.
It is. I love that. And that's really where truth lies.
Yeah, yeah, truth is kind of unnameable, and of course the ultimate truth is also unnameable.
Right.
But then we have to name things that are unnameable. You know, even I don't know, cup or spoon or things like that. If you get into the so-called mundane world, you can actually step back from even that and go, okay, this isn't, you know, I call this spoon, but it has its own reality that is beyond the name I've given it.
Right, the spoon is the distinction, right.
Yeah, and yourself is also that. Yourself isn't limited in the way your brain kind of, by necessity, has to limit things.
Right, for survival.
Yeah.
So that's what's cool about Zen Buddhism, is that you can actually surrender in your meditations, surrender your survival.
And it's, yeah, it's true, and it's very hard to do because you have to, you're giving up something that you thought was really precious. But what's interesting in the process is that when you give it up, you find nothing has really changed, except that you've lost this sort of neurotic clinging to something that wasn't really real to begin with.
That feels good.
Yeah, yeah.
So you must have a lot of feeling good during your meditations. And also, you talk about how you meditate in your book, and it's not a forced meditation. It's not, oh, I have to stop my thinking, or I should breathe through my left nostril, or whatever.
Yeah, it's very open. I hate to sound sectarian or anything, but I feel like this form of meditation is kind of is amazing to me because it doesn't start with a conclusion. You're not directed towards anything, even mindfulness or calmness or, you know, centeredness or God or anything. You're just kind of, it's very, very open-ended. And that's what bothers a lot of people about it, and it's what makes a lot of people give it up.
they need more direction.
because there's no direction. But what's amazing is if you learn to be comfortable with no direction, you can be comfortable anywhere because you're no longer searching for something outside yourself for validity. You just behave. According to, my teacher would say, according to circumstances was the way he always put it.
Right. But it serves you.
Kind of blend.
It serves you to have routines.
Well, of course, yeah. I mean, and that's the kind of interesting, another one of these interesting paradoxes. If you go to a Zen temple, it's all about routine. You know, the routine is kind of strictly enforced at some temples, even in a way that people find almost militaristic. But in that routine, that allows you to a kind of freedom. And I think that's why we human beings kind of gravitate towards routines. You know, we chafe at having to go to our job at 9 in the morning or whatever it is. But I think ultimately we kind of desire that sort of regularity.
Yeah, people who retire don't know what to do with themselves because they don't have their routines.
Oh, yeah, that's for sure.
Yeah. So this is really out of the routine to talk about God, and it's so much fun. I've always loved the opportunity to talk to anybody about God because it's just so much fun to seesaw about it and just kind of play with it. And so you cover so much in the book, and so I want to come back to that. There are only a couple minutes left. And so the book is called "There Is No God, and He Is Always with You." And you've written a bunch of books. You were on the show previously with a different book, and your name is Brad Warner. How can people find you or get your book? Or...
Okay, the best place to find all the stuff is my website, which is hardcorezen.info. Hardcore Zen was the name of my first book, and it's .info because we couldn't get .com.
Okay.
But hardcorezen.info is my blog with all kinds of stuff and bad jokes.
Good. I'm sure God will love your jokes.
Yeah, well, probably only him.
This is so much fun talking with you, and I want to thank you for writing this book. It's great to have read it and to know you, and thank you so much for being a guest on Energy Stew.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome. And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I can be reached at peter@heartriver, heartriver.org, or 212-222-7748. I'd love to hear from you, and thank you so much for listening.